Live, local, and unafraid, this is Hudson Valley Focus with Tom Sipas on The Beacon.
On The Beacon, 707 on The Beacon, Harold King, Johnny Ann Hansen, councilofindustry.org in studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Tom.
It's lovely to be here.
I'm glad you're here. It looks like a nice looking morning out
it
there.
It is very nice.
The sun's
nice
starting
out
to come up. And of course, it's hard to believe we're less than 2 weeks away from having to change the clocks.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So,
don't mention that to Harold. It's a bit of a trigger moment.
Yeah. Uh-oh.
it's a double-edged sword, actually, because I'm a morning person, so I'm up early. So it's nice to have that sunlight in the morning, a little bit of light when you're out walking the dog.
Sure.
But it's rough going home. And honestly, I can take the cold. I don't mind the cold in the winter, but those short days, dark, it wears on me.
It certainly does. So
I think they call that seasonal depression.
Yeah.
I'd like to think
we were talking about that with
Andrew
O'Grady.
You can just walk it off, though.
Yeah.
Talking about that with Andrew O'Grady from Mental Health America last week. It's a serious issue.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's one of those things, too, you just have to like kind of be mindful of it. Like, what are you going to do?
You make sure you maintain that, but
how do you make sure that you don't fall into that, or that once you're in there, you just kind of
Newton's law of physics, objects at rest want to stay at rest.
Yeah.
And so when you're in that thing, I don't want to do anything.
Right.
So keeping yourself going and moving is really important.
Absolutely.
Very true.
So, Harold, what'd you think about the big internet outage yesterday? Man, how vulnerable are we?
It is. It was something. It obviously, as people that are engaged with the internet and using information is a big part of what we do every day. We ran into some things. Ran into some transaction troubles.
Mm-hmm.
It was reassuring that it wasn't a cyber attack, right? It was just a software patch. I'm pretty sure with their explanation was pretty clear, and they were able to fix it pretty quickly. But yeah, there is a lot of vulnerability, and as we get more and more reliant, scary, is the only word I can use in that vulnerability. We're talking with utilities a lot of times. We're talking with defense contractors, and this CMMC movement and the requirements on cybersecurity are getting significant
sure.
and stronger. And you talk to the folks at various utilities, and they're getting attacked hourly, and they're fending off attacks constantly.
So I got home yesterday morning, 10:30, 11 o'clock, and Joanne was there. I've been trying to get on the, she and Ava are going to England.
Oh, great.
Well, great!
And you have to pre-register.
Mm.
Oh, is it that quickly? Are they leaving soon? Are they now?
November.
Oh, okay.
But you have to download the app and the UK entry form.
So I was like, well, do you know there's a internet outage? No. And so I said, well, there's an internet outage, and tried to explain it to her. Then I went and looked it up, and guess who Amazon service is? UK.gov.
That's the one. Yeah.
That was my actual observation was the interconnectedness. Like, on one hand, there's the pros of how quickly we can get things and how, these big safe organizations have your cloud information and they're protecting it and giving you access, but how quickly that goes away and how interconnected it all is.
Cursory understanding of what happened, but apparently it was an upload to a database that Amazon Web Services maintains and uses a lot of it's a database service that a lot of companies use, and they just put a wrong DNS in there. Like they in the patch, somebody typed a 2.5 instead of a 5.2 or whatever the in that 30 number extension, and it crashed and crashed that database, which so many different services were using. So it's simple, and they fixed it quickly, but the ripple effect was amazing about how different things got triggered.
Not everything is fixed even as of now.
They're still patching things,
and but even things like people with their Ring doorbells.
Well, it in a self-inflicted wound. It hit Amazon. Yes. Of course, they got their site up faster than anybody else's. It's something. But you know, to that point, Tom, you know, we're a new part of what we're doing is trying to help our members stay up to date with cyber protocols and requirements. And so we're connected with the FBI, we're connected with CISA, and we're just trying to, you know, get people as much information as they can and as many resources as they can. One of the things, particularly in the manufacturing world, is, you know, they're subject to being hacked.
Yes.
You know, particularly a lot of defense contractors are, you know, second, third, fourth tier defense contractors. There's their access points to the big guys and to the Pentagon. So you know they need to be on their toes and they need to have certain protocols. And they also get hit with these attacks. And then you know there's at least now is an avenue to report them.
So I'm laughing because I thinking back, you and I worked together for almost the better part of 30 years that now. None of this stuff was in our vocabulary back then. I mean, think how much has changed.
Well, and you know, we always ask, you know, all these CEOs what they have to do, but think about that CEO who's our age, you know, who's been through all this stuff. It's like, I just want to sell my widget to these guys. Yeah. What the heck? I didn't want this damn website. What the hell are you talking about? You know,
I told you not to get a website.
I told you we didn't need email. You know, like you can imagine all those conversations. But yeah, at least and now there's an avenue, you know, to report things, and there's a database where they're, you know, then the FBI is working on investigations, and they're trying to, you know, root people out. And it's, you know, it's nice that our members can be a part of that, you know, crime prevention, work. But it's also relentless and expensive.
Yeah, I was going to add that, you know, we as a small organization take for granted that, you know, we're not dealing with that. Our stuff's not there. Right. Yeah. But we don't realize that, you know, if we're dealing with this one interface and they are storing their things there. So, I mean, a couple of years ago, we had an email hacking incident that, you know, there was a big report about organizations being hacked. And we're like, well, that's not us because we go through Tom and Tom's not that. And they're like, oh, wait, but Tom uses
that
this.
So uses that service.
Right. So it's interesting because you think I know the reason they call these
And viruses too, because think about how they do mutate and change and transfer from one organism to another.
We've had a number of companies. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say. So when you think about it too, there's like a whole vendor management process. So I mean, companies have to do some due diligence beyond just I use Tom. Right. So they're like, OK, well, now you have to document that you use Tom, and then you have to document then where does Tom take that data? And then where does that data go to that person? So on a positive side, there are processes in which we can prevent and know. But on the negative side, that takes time and energy. And, you know, if you're a small to mid-sized company and you don't necessarily have a person who does this for a living, that's daunting. I mean, I just remember I worked in the bank. So there was vendor management and it was an entire job. I mean, like an entire department of just making sure. So I could call and say, I found this cool training software. And they're like, you think you found this cool training software, but we're going to spend 6 months having to vet out where does our information go? I'm like, it's really just the username and password. It's not that big of a deal. And they're like, you think that, but so it, you know, the layers go back deeper than even we know.
Yep. We've had a number of our members be hit by ransomware attacks and to varying degree of success. And you know, one of them, you know, noteworthy, kind of came through the you know, the smart building software. You know, we can turn on our heat and we can manage our lighting and that utility bill remotely. And you know, the air conditioning goes off and we can update it from home or another site. That was
that was their weak point. Also, I think that one interesting part of that story was it happened, it was planted or whatever the words are over the summer during the middle of a night in an upgrade, and it just stayed dormant and it was there. And then they did an attack in like February of the next year. So, I mean, it was something that they didn't know happened then, and then, you know, ended up getting the creepy things that you see on the movies where just the screen gets taken over and they're writing you a message that says, you know, give us this money or we're gonna get rid, you know, we're gonna sell all your stuff to the dark web.
7:16 on Hudson Valley Focus Live, Harold King, Johnny Ann Hansen in studio. We're talking about, you know, this interconnected world here. Life, exactly. But right now let's hear from the Zolls and then back in a minute on the Beacon.
The Voice of the Valley, Hudson Valley Focus with Tom Sipas on The Beacon.
7:21 on The Beacon on this Tuesday morning. Hell King, Johnny Ann Hansen, Council of Industry.org in a studio with me. And Harold Moore, thinking about the conversation we were just having about the interconnectedness of this. And of course, the further out you go with the supply lines, and I saw a graph the other day, I assume, or, you know, an illustration. It was showing like where Boeing aircraft sources their parts from.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
That is that's a map of the globe.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And the, you know, becoming overly dependent on one source, and the lack of redundancy, it seems, in some of these internet connections is really a problem. I saw an article about that already this morning.
Yeah, you know, I mean, so, Johnny, I mentioned, you know, vendor management and, you know, supply chain management is huge. I mean, obviously, you know, through the decades, you know, you know or are familiar with the just-in-time management system, mm-hmm. inventory management system, which we all embraced because it was extremely efficient. You find supplier partners that can deliver things to you just when you need them in your manufacturing process.
So you're not paying to hold inventory. So
exactly, which is extremely expensive.
Sure.
Exactly. A space as well as, you know, owning that material. And then we saw how vulnerable that made people during the pandemic when, you know, one piece of that went down in any way, shape, or form, whether that was a factory that closed because they had an outbreak or however that manifested itself. And then if one vendor couldn't get his part, then he couldn't deliver for the next person in his supply chain and so forth and so on. And so, you know, for the last 5 or 6 years, the trend has been to build in redundancy, to get multiple sources of supply, to maintain a little bit of inventory, to look and see what we need. Well, just in time really meant for us, you know, 3 days or 5 days. Well, now looking at maybe it's 2 weeks worth of inventory that we can hold. Maybe we do hold some of the smaller, mm-hmm. More expensive pieces and things of that nature. but it is fascinating to see, and it's how it's playing out now with trade wars, and the cost of certain materials from certain places. People are looking for domestic suppliers because their products ostensibly will be cheaper and more available. And it is some really complicated math that's going on. What is fascinating to me is how artificial intelligence is playing a role in this, and companies are using that to try and sort through things. Because if you look at Boeing's the extreme, right?
Yes.
How many parts are there in an airplane? Other things, like we always use our friends at MPI as an example. They have a couple of thousand parts that are in their machines that they need to have. That's still a lot, and that's a lot of some come from the same vendors, but that's still they're maintaining a lot of different vendors. So it's fascinating to see how they're trying to build models, and companies are building models to help manufacturers manage their supply chains and upgrade them and make them more stable, more strong, more redundant. And that is not just parts. As we are seeing, it is vendors as well, it's services as well, and it is including some of these web services. So if you have
a little bit of that disaster recovery concepts, right? What would happen if this one supplier couldn't get you what you needed to do? What do you need to do? And what would happen if this one internet provider?
What about if your main supplier for your aluminum for your F-150 pickup truck had a big fire
and is now
shut down?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Ford faces, this is a story out 14 hours ago. Ford faces possible layoffs after fire halts a major aluminum supplier in there, and this plant may not be back online.
Well, that fire happened months ago, they're just kind of fiddling it through. And what's fascinating with that particular, I think it's a Novelis, is that what mm-hmm. it is? What's fascinating with that is, Ford had gone to them as a, because they used recycled materials. They were actually using aluminum, scrap aluminum, and making their fresh aluminum from scrap, which is great for their sustainability profile and great for the F-150, which is one of the few trucks that uses aluminum.
Yeah.
It was an innovation to make it lighter and more fuel efficient.
Sure. It says a whopping 36% of the U.S. auto industry's aluminum supply flows from there, with Ford leaning hard on it for its prize F-150 pickup truck. And I mentioned the other day, I think maybe as a result of seeing this story as well, back in, and I remember if it was 1953 or 57, General Motors had a, their, that's when automatic transmissions were really, 1950s coming into, mm-hmm. into being. Everybody wanted one. And they had a sole source for their hydromatic transmission. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the largest industrial fires in America. And it, and actually, I think actually triggered a recession.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah, because it, it was so, so impacted the auto industry.
Right.
The,
well, you look at Ford, I mean, how much of their profit comes from the F-150? I mean, that's yeah. the, that's one of their best-selling, most highest margin vehicles. And so that you can see something similar happening. But yeah, I mean, the supply chain and the ripple and the you know, the difficulties, as Johnny Ann mentioned, I mean, it's that building those redundancies is critical, but it's expensive. It's also yeah. takes a lot of time out of your day when yeah. you just need to get that product out
the door. And if that's the only thing you're working on, that's lovely. Right. But that's not the only thing that's, you know, keeping people up at night. That's not right. the only thing coming at them.
Which kind of comes back one more time to a conversation we had last week about project management.
Absolutely.
That is like, that is a project. We are going to build some redundancy into our supply chain. How do we do that?
That's
and
good.
That's a, you know, not an easy one, but it is a project.
Well, I can go all the way back to the late 1980s, early 1990s with our insurance business. And we had a pretty good diversification of the kinds of insurance that we sold mm-hmm. in our customer base. But we were local. We didn't have a geographic distribution.
Right. Mm.
And when the Hudson Valley got hit so hard, and it rippled across everything. I mean, my, you know, manufacturer who made the sheet metal components for the IBM mainframe yeah. cooling right. systems
sure.
calls me up on a Thursday and says, we're locking our doors tomorrow. The real estate developer who was, you know, paying me $175,000 a year for his contractor's liability and stuff says, we're packing it in. And, and basically every service business throughout the Hudson Valley region lost 40% of its business.
Yeah, yeah, and if you can survive at 60% and how can rebuild, that's great. But a lot of folks couldn't. Yeah.
And this is I probably should get somebody in. I've talked about this before, and I never have really followed through on doing it. We're talking about the business perpetuation planning. Mm-hmm. You and I have spoken about this yeah. many times, and you've had
sure.
meetings, I think, with some of your folks about it, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Yeah, and it's just statistically, it's the same percentage in 2025 who don't have a business perpetuation plan as yeah. it was in 1970 when yeah, I started with my dad.
Yep.
Yeah, we'll talk during the break, but because I don't know if we want to bring it up, but yeah, I mean, it's really so important, and you know, not just from the you know, the financial side of it, but from the family side of it too, to understand.
I was going to
Wall Street Journal yesterday about
piece.
Wealthy families like actually developing family mission statements and everybody
yes.
signing on board for that purpose, you know, just to say, this is how we want to manage, this is who we want to be in this world, generation to generation.
Exactly. Harold King, Johnny Ann Hansen, Council of Industry, 7:30, back in a minute on Hudson Valley Focus Live on The Beacon.
Wake up informed. It's Hudson Valley Focus with Tom Sipas on The Beacon.
It is Hudson Valley Focus on The Beacon, 7:34 on this Tuesday morning. So Council of Industry, the second and third Tuesdays of the month. Harold King and Johnny Ann Hansen are usually in here. Sometimes it's Harold.
Yeah, we like to rotate.
And sometimes it's Johnny Ann, and sometimes it's Harold and Johnny Ann.
Yeah. Right. And sometimes we bring in that third party. Sometimes
that's exactly right. We haven't done that in a long time in terms of bringing in one of your manufacturers
in
or
somebody. These months go fast.
They do.
We leave here every time saying, you know what we need to do? And then you're like, man, it's Tuesday already.
And we don't like to give up our time. We think that you can speak to those manufacturers on your own time. So we're happy to make those arrangements, which we've done with Aaron and Steve and some folks.
With a couple of Steves.
A couple of Steves.
From donuts
and they
to bearings.
They deserve their own time.
That's a good
exactly.
Both circular, both rings. I like that.
Yeah, exactly. So unless you want to talk about something else, often over the years, we've talked about the cost of regulation.
Ah.
Okay. And the article that I came up with from Reason Magazine, the federal government's 175,000 pages of regulations turn the rule of law into a cruel joke. And this is what I've said over the years, that the administrative state that's operating extra constitutionally, they're up outside of their framework as created by Congress, but they've taken it on themselves and just added stuff without due process.
There's we were talking about this a little bit coming into the show this morning. Yeah, there's some momentum that happens with bureaucracies. It's funny, I heard you talking earlier as well, and I heard you talking about Woodrow Wilson, and as your listeners may or may not know, but I have a master's degree in public administration, and Woodrow Wilson is the father of public administration.
Yeah.
And you see my air quotes, the science
of
public administration. And in its purest form, it is taking experts, people with informed knowledge to administer program, to ensure government efficiency, to make sure that it is doing what it's supposed to do for the citizens of whatever government, whether local, state, federal.
Right.
And that, unfortunately, over time, morphs into its own creature. And we certainly, both personally and professionally, deal with a lot of bureaucracies, and they can be extremely frustrating, and they can lose all rationality.
Absolutely.
And I think we've seen that in a lot of areas. Now, that is not to say, and we also saying the same thing, that we don't need regulation. We need we need boundaries. We need reasonable.
You say boundaries. I say a framework.
A framework. Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, whether you're raising children or pets or citizens or economies, you need rails and you need boundaries. And so we need all that. But when those boundaries become like morphed into some new quasi control government, it's very frustrating, and there's no accountability.
That's
and,
correct.
And that, I think that is the frustration, and ridiculously expensive for no good reason.
Well, NAM in 2022, National Association of Manufacturers estimated that at $3.079 trillion. That's basically 10% of their entire U.S. economy. Hmm. 2025 report from the Competitive Enterprise Institute estimated another $2.155 trillion. And the problem is, as you said, Harold King, it starts out maybe with good intentions. Mm-hmm. I'm not always so sure.
Not always.
But we talked a couple minutes ago about, you know, the shutdown in the internet and how rapidly the world had changed. With these regulations that come out of these administrative agencies, they have to codify everything. And by the time they're often done, you know, the scribes are done, 20% of the world has changed.
Mm.
And
that's a good point.
And it does not keep up with it. And they cannot respond. It casts it in concrete. This is particularly destructive in our healthcare industry after Obamacare came out. It's not a political statement. It's absolute fact that they had to, you know, there was a 2,000-page law, and then I don't know what the latest count was on regulations. It was another 20,000 pages or something like that.
Easily.
And now you have the latest estimates I've seen. I went back and I checked this. I was saying that government paperwork was adding one-third to the cost of our healthcare in this country. The latest estimates are it's 50%. And when you go into a medical office and talk to people and see how many people are there administrating all these layers, and that's only one small portion of the whole supply chain and doing that, it is about 50%.
I think the NAM study in particular was focused on the small and mid-sized manufacturers.
Yes.
Because I think one of the things you see with the healthcare industry is that consolidation that's occurring, and so many small practices selling out, but be kind of forced to, because they need to comply. You need some depth of your own bureaucracy to deal with the bureaucracy, your own administration to do with that. So if you're a practice with three doctors doing a pediatrics practice, you say to yourself, are we going to add two more admins, or are we just going to sell to these people who are going to give us a whole ton of money? So we see it too with smaller businesses. Hey, listen, if you're Boeing, you've got an army of attorneys. You've got filing the paperwork. You're working with the FAA. You're doing all those things. If you're the supplier, these things really become more of a burden.
So
I was going to add that I was on the Putnam County Economic Development Symposium panel.
Excellent.
And someone was there and did a presentation about New York State. They were talking a little bit about how another state had taken all their regulations and put it through an appropriate AI, and how many duplications and redundancies, and they were able to cut that down. But I had this slide that it said when 2023 and 2024, we increased by 24,195 pieces of regulation introduced in New York State. So that's
Give me those numbers again, please.
Okay, 24,195 pieces of regulation introduced in 2023 and 2024 in just New York State.
Wow.
And then under that, it says currently over 300,000 regulations in New York State containing 17 million words in total. And so what they're proposing is that there needs to be some process, some automated process that takes that down to a reasonable amount so that there's less time spent figuring out the loopholes and the workarounds, and that organizations that aren't just big and having all those resources and people, but the smaller companies can actually compete and get what they need.
Interestingly, when I put up this article yesterday about the from Reason Magazine, and then Pat Alder had messaged me saying whether or not AI could help sort through this. Well, Forbes just had an article about this on July 28th of this year. Doge built an AI to delete half of federal regulations. Will it work? And this really gets into the hundreds of thousands of rules and, as you said, millions of words that are in here. And I think this is going to be some Doge analysis suggests that repealing 100,000 regulations through traditional means would require about 3.6 million man hours of legal and policy work. This includes the time required to research the law, draft repeal notices, etc. Using AI tool, the presentation claims this workload could be reduced by 93%.
Yeah, I believe that.
And honestly, can you think of a better use of AI than to just go through all this? I mean, it's
Yes, maybe. Because one of the things I am really hopeful in the medical field that they can use that to really, whether it's drug interactions, whether it's causes of, any of those things. That's where I, on the flip side, I honestly do not see AI eliminating these millions of jobs that people are doing. I see it evolving, certainly not overnight. I don't see it.
Yeah, but I mean, wouldn't it be better to use those government employees in a different way, in a way that could be more beneficial, instead of figuring out those loopholes and going through regulations manually?
Maybe we don't need them as
a
taxpayer expense. Maybe we have shortages.
Be taxpayers.
Seriously,
they are, by the way.
I understand that, but we need additional workers in the private sector.
Yeah,
I mean, we're not talking about a switch where this happens and it happens overnight, but I'd like to think that that's the case. And kudos, was it the New York State Economic Development Council? Kudos for them to doing that report. And
I just forwarded you that. Okay. And it's,
it's really important research. And our friends at the Empire Center have been saying this for a long time, and they're looking at ways to improve the efficiency. And I think, to your point earlier, Tom, sorry, Johnny, it just kind of takes on a life of its own. I mean, that's where it is. And it's human nature. You don't want, obviously, you're not going to look for ways to put yourself out of work. Right. Like, we can do that. That's good. No, we'll do that. Yeah, and you can't do that. And we'll figure it out.
I remember about 10 years ago, I was at an energy conference with some folks here locally. And I had just seen an article about the federal budget for the Rural Electrification Agency. Hmm. And all these utility executives looked at me and said, wait a minute.
They're still
in business. their job was fulfilled like 80 years ago or 60 years ago, whatever the heck it was. But yes, they still had this, you know, millions of dollars line item in the budget.
Yeah. And you see, we see mission creep all over. I mean, even, you know, one of, and this is not their fault. This is actually a legislative creep. But the New York Power Authority is, you know, now heavily engaged. They used to be in charge of public generation of the hydro plants and upstate and disseminating that power. And, you know, now they're involved with all kinds of, you know, things in terms of sustainability and other things. And we're going to hear about economic development programs. We're going to hear about that from their I forget her title, but she's a keynote speaker at our luncheon in November. And it's interesting. I mean, they're doing a lot of really important things. Mostly around their original core mission of generating low-cost power.
Yeah. Let's get a quick break in here, 7:46 on Hudson Valley Focus Live on The Beacon. We'll hear from the Zolls with Sportsbrit and then back with Harold and Johnny Ann.
Now, back to Hudson Valley Focus with Tom Sipas on The Beacon.
. 7:50 on Hudson Valley Focus Live. Harold King, let's see. President of the Council of Industry and Johnny Ann Hansen, CEO of the Council.
We're fancy here.
Oh, there we go. Very fancy.
Only the best for your time.
I don't know, Robbie. We need some. We should have some titles here or something, huh?
I give it to myself.
You know. Okay.
Master of the Universe. Of this room.
Of this room, yeah.
The
controller of the board.
Okay. There you go.
I like that.
You go. So, been doing a lot behind the scenes here, getting retooling the whole show as we're coming up to 1 year over here.
It's
on
been that long. Good.
Beacon already, and have a whole list of new bumper music.
Yeah, looking forward to that. That's actually something I missed from the old show.
Everybody tells me that. Everybody tells me that. So a huge shout out and thank you to Randy Turner, who I gave him this whole long list, and yesterday we got sorted out how we're going to do this, and by the time yesterday afternoon he had them all put into different files, and now it has to get into the computer and
for the board master of the universe.
The board master of the universe. And I really was having a lot of trouble visualizing the mechanics of, because I don't do that stuff of putting it in there,
right,
and how it was all going to mesh up and merge and all. But I think we had a little conference call here yesterday, and Terry O'Donnell, who's, you know, kind of oversees the stuff at that level, and Randy and I, and so I think we got it all sorted out.
Excellent.
And now I have to build it in. But I agree. And it's energizing to me.
Yeah. I believe it. I mean, it's, and you know, get a little bit of a hop in the step.
In your seat.
Exactly.
Sure. So
that's good behind the scenes.
So Robbie, I think after 8 o'clock, I think we'll have to. Last week, I found 10 songs that were banned in the 1960s.
I remember you saying that.
Yeah, so we were doing them, and now I have another one, 20 most controversial forgotten bands of the 1960s. So, we'll do a couple of them this morning. It really is. We've done a lot with the changing demographics. We're talking about changing technologies.
Yeah, you gotta keep
this
up.
Is all part of the world we live in.
You got to keep up.
Yeah, maybe you could do a little service for the demographic of your listeners on just introducing them to contemporary music and explaining what the hell it all means. This is what your kids are listening. This is what your grandkids are listening to, and this is why you might want to understand. Oh, what
well, maybe that's true. That's
just
true,
a little segment. Just a little thing.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
That.
So
you could do a segment where you just like ask ChatGPT, "What does that mean?" Do it live. You're like, "What does it mean?"
Yeah. What is that song? Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
But what is also interesting,
that was good timing here.
What is interesting, we were talking about this yesterday when Tony Marmo was here, about how many kids, like granddaughter Ava's 20 now, or daughter Jessica, who, you know, how many of them, how many times did they watch Grease over the years because of the music?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
And that really has a, you know, it covers multiple generations for sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
I actually think I know more about the music than I do the actual movie. I don't really have that. But the like the 34-year-old like,
high school kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or what was the other one? American Graffiti.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they're definitely just, I mean, songs just kind of have that soundtrack to your life, right? And that just give you that, remind you of the time. And can relive it over and over again.
Yeah.
And transports it very quickly.
Yeah, sure.
It really does. But, you know, I know I took the conversation off in this direction, but I'm thinking about how much has really changed, and maybe the pendulum swung away from, I mean, I grew up in an era with that music when, like, every high school had their shop classes and trades, right. Industrial arts, and but it seems like, you know, full the circle. Pendulum coming back.
You mentioned that theme. The film Mr. Holland's Opus, the Richard Dreyfuss. I'm not sure it started in that. But anyway, but that chronicles his career over, you know, 30 plus almost 40 years,
right.
As a music teacher in high school, and part of that is kind of the soundtrack of those years as it progresses through, and it's fun for that reason. You know, he starts in the 60s and finishes in the 90s, and it's interesting to see and hear and listen and see what kids were listening to and wearing and all that stuff through it. It's fun. Yeah. It's a good movie.
I think you're right about the pendulum, though, because I think you tend to go, like, you know, whether it's really, really heavy and just like, and then all of a sudden, like, this acoustic movement will come out and everything's really light. And I think maybe music will get there with like digitalization, you know, kind of cool, look at all the fun things I can do. And then you're like, okay, that's not actually that interesting. I'd really rather just hear you sing. And then I think it's true.
You don't
and I
want
think
to hear me sing.
No, me either. Definitely not. But I think you're right about, you know, teaching styles and technologies and how, you know, maybe we stepped away from it for a bit, but it does seem like that has, you know, shifted back to recognize that these types of hands-on skills are equally important, and those opportunities to try and learn and work on projects as a younger individual actually does build those
foundations. So that takes me back also to, like, food and nutrition and how we went, you know, in these intervening 50 years, a lot of the ultra processed foods, but now coming back, but that, you know, go back to what was, you know, some of those Elvis Presley movies about, you know, dancing on the beach and all, and look at the builds of people.
Frank Annanette.
Yeah, but look at the builds of people then versus where we are now. Mm-hmm. There's been actually a fair amount written about that now, and now we're really paying an awful price for health issues with even young people. I've noticed recently, Harold, you follow sports, I think, a lot more than I do. There's been some relatively young sports people who have passed away at, you know, in their 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
And you just really wonder what the heck is going on.
Yeah, I mean, along those same lines, I know colon cancer is something that's popping up in young people much more frequently than it did centuries ago. So
and that's something that I've had doctors on with me, very concerned about that. Doctors who have been in practice for, you know, like 30 years,
right.
Where they can say, oh, wow, we've witness this really big change.
And some things you can you know, chalk up to better diagnosis and better, you know, better
catching
screening and so forth, but that this is not
no.
one of those cases.
No.
This is just like, what the heck?
Prediabetes, fatty liver diseases, so bringing that back to the food manufacturing industry.
Honestly, when our magazine comes out, you'll see we're doing a story on one of our food producers, Caribbean Food Delights. But the, you know, the trend of healthy ingredients, you know,
around. I mean, it's all interconnected.
And you know, removing preservatives, which was actually, to their credit has always been their product.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
So now they're, you know, it's a little bit more more in line. But even they are looking for ways to reduce fat and to remove preservatives and those types of things.
I think it's also, we need efficiencies. We need to find fast. We need to TV dinner it. And then you're just like, you swap out of that and you're like, actually, you need to make your own food. You're right. Changing that. And then at some point they're like, we need to do this a little bit faster because, right. You know, the time of that. I think I heard somebody mention yesterday that there's fine dining frozen is like a trend.
Yeah, okay.
Right? So you get good, high quality, fine dining type food, and but you can get it pre-made and frozen.
Frozen, yeah. Often it does retain the nutrient density.
Yeah. So they're right. Trying to find that balance of like very high quality food, but that you don't need to spend hours and hours to prepare.
So this crisp, cool weather coming to split pea with ham time.
Yeah, that's so right. That's right.
We should have like a competition here one day, and maybe. I'll bring mine and you bring yours.
I like
and
that.
We'll
I've kind of shifted to the chickpea soup.
Have
it's
you?
It's my new go to. Went to Greece and had that, and I very much enjoy it.
Both actually, I've had both your split pea soup and your absolutely.
I'm a big fan of beef barley. It's so one of these we'll be making some of that pretty soon.
Yeah. I'm a fan of whatever somebody brings. That's my favorite. It's just like, oh, that's my favorite soup.
People,
thank you so
people
much.
People just tuning in now saying, what the hell are these people talking about?
Yeah, well, someone had to make that.
But seriously, I mean, this conversation took a circle over the last hour, but the interconnectedness is real. Harold King, Johnny Ann Hansen, thanks for being on Hudson Valley Focus listening.